Hello and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. This is Gabriel Krauser speaking. We are halfway through the week and nearly halfway through the shortest month of the year. I'm here joined to talk about the what really matters with Sarah Gon.
Hi, but did you remember that this month has 29 days?
Ah, leap year.
Still the shortest day of the month.
Still the shortest year.
Okay, we're getting it together. I'm also joined by Marius Ruett.
How's it, Gabriel?
How's it? The I think most important news story of the day is that the Americans have come out once again to say that South Africa might be disqualified from AGOA. Sarah, tell us about that.
Okay, well, basically what Trump has been aiming to do is to sort of narrow the list of developing and undeveloped countries. And to this extent, they want to remove South Africa from the list of developing countries. So it'll be regarded as developed. And In 2018, our exports to the U.S. under the agreement amounted to about 218 billion rand. So this is not looking good, and I'm not sure that we're doing ourselves any favors in the way we deal with the Americans on this matter. I mean, this is for our economy, it's pretty grim.
Yeah, it's serious. The balance of trade, the effects it can have on the rand, the effects it can have on our manufacturing sector, which has shrunk relative to what it should have been doing tremendously, potentially very dangerous. Marius, why do you think this call has come now?
Well, I think it's probably been coming for a while. I mean, we've been poking the American bear for years, literally. I mean, the way we vote in the UN, I think we, along with countries like North Korea and Iran, have the most anti-American voting record in the UN, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nikki Haley, the former U.S. ambassador exactly. to the UN,
can't expect the Americans to keep, you know, being on our side and giving us nice things and so on. And I think there's a lot of goodwill to South Africa from the U.S., especially in the 90s under Bill Clinton, even under George Bush, and probably Barack Obama. But I think their patience has run out with us now. And I think, we saw now Kusatu was recently outside the American consulate in Joburg, singing "One American, One Bullet." I mean, so and we must remember we are an economic backwater compared to the US. I mean, we need them far more than they need us.
Kasat is essentially shooting this economy in the foot.
Yeah, well, I think they shot the economy in the head already a while ago, to be honest.
I think it's important to point out that this is a bipartisan thing. Mm-hmm. So the trade agreement under which we qualify as a developing nation, which means that we don't have to jump through the same tariff loops and hoops as America's bigger economic competitors, don't apply. We kind of get a free ticket to their market. Barack Obama quite seriously looked at disqualifying us from that status during his second term. A lot of it had to do with chicken, which is a hugely important sector in the agri chain, and we were not prepared to sort of play according to the rules that they preferred and take what we saw to be sort of massive dumping of chicken. And I think people know a little bit about this kind of tension with the UK and the US. Chlorinated chicken is going to be one of the contentious points of concern during their trade agreements. But so the point is that Obama had thought that he had good enough reason to potentially disqualify us and seriously threatened it. And Trump's been in a similar position. Of course, what's changed is that to qualify for AGOA, there's two senses of are you a developing nation? One is, are you relatively poor enough to qualify as developing rather than developed Sweden? The other is, are you developing in the sense that you are progressing towards a more liberal, stable market economy, or are you going the other way? And so the introduction of expropriation without compensation, slashing the Bill of Rights, setting up the platform to then further undermine civil liberties and really to shunt the free market, I think is a very credible, if you read the text of AGOA, if you really peruse it as I've done, you see that this completely would disqualify us as being a developing nation. Not because we're too rich, but because we're not going in the right direction. On the other hand, we are also much richer than most of our African neighbors. That they can get us on both ends. And I think part of what the Americans are doing is trying to find the most diplomatically or politically palatable way to apply pressure to us. So in the end, the reason they might give might have to do with intellectual property rights, which we're currently sort of redrafting in ways that concern Netflix and other major content producers in the States. Also, we might be too rich. Also, we might be too socialist.
It seems to be a hallmark of Cyril Ramaphosa's government, that we don't seem to understand that you don't get something for nothing. So in other words, if you want 218 billion rands worth of export, you've got to be prepared to advance human rights, not negate them. And, and that seems to be missing. Either it's being done for an ideological reason, or it's just anything to kind of be seen to poke the bear.
But is the ANC going to be all that worried? I mean, we know that they're not too concerned what's going on in the economy. And, I mean, they have been trying to sort of point our foreign policy direction, if not to Russia under Zuma, now I think more to China under Ramaphosa. So, I mean, is anybody in the ANC actually going to be too worried? Would they care if this is going to cost 20,000 jobs, 100,000 jobs, 5,000 jobs? I mean, I'm not sure that they would be too bothered.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I agree that there are some that are going to see the sort of potential political boon that comes out of seeing a foreign enemy as being more useful than the economic cost. And a further thing to add to that is if you look at Venezuela apologists, I think in South Africa, when it comes to EWC, we look at Zimbabwe, and that's very important, but we should really look to Venezuela because they were the richest economy in the region, which Zimbabwe was not, because they were the most sophisticated and diversified economy, which Zimbabwe was not, and because they really do this by-the-book incremental thing, where first they said we're going to do EWC on agricultural land only, and we're only going to do it on a very limited sort of kind of agricultural land, and eventually ramped that up. Which looks like the path that we're on. Venezuelan apologists today who sort of think that socialism is great, but that something went wrong there, generally say, well, the problem is not the policies of the Venezuelan government. The problem is that sanctions were imposed against them by white, imperial, American, capitalist-dominating...
Stooges. Evil
demons.
Dogs, capitalist running dogs.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
And so the sooner we get to get kicked out of AGOA, the sooner we get sanctions, the sooner anything that like that happens, the more readily we can blame the Americans for South Africa's woes, which I think would be useful for that faction of the ANC that knows that at some point just blaming apartheid for the country's woes becomes politically empty.
There was some kind of sanctions put on the Guptas, I think. They couldn't bank with any American banks or something like that. So I think it's already, I mean, that's kind of the thin edge of the wedge. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
And also people in Zimbabwe also say there's sanctions what ruined the Zimbabwean economy, even though it was actually only sanctions against about 100 individuals.
Yeah.
So
no, it's all just...
Yeah, but I think going after the Guptas was strategically brilliant. Belinda Mazzoli has not opened a docket against the Guptas. It's crazy. We seem to have so much evidence against them. And as one telling data point, Eusebius Mokhaizer, who really hates the United States in so many ways, came on his show that day to say, well, guys, you know, they've done one good thing.
Why were you listening to Eusebius, Gabriel?
I was driving the Institute of Race Relations car, and the radio...
You can't change it. You can't change it.
The radio's stuck.
Look, you're a millennial. You should be able to be good at this technology, man.
I'm fixated.
Mine, you don't have a cell phone at the moment, so who knows.
I'm caught.
Let's not dwell. Okay, so we've got Sona coming up, Marius. It's very important. It's very interesting. Tell us about Sona.
Sona is going to be more of the same. It's not going to be really worth listening to. The FF is going to probably try make some noise and make the whole spectacle about themselves. But really, I mean, I'd be very surprised if we see anything noteworthy coming tomorrow except for more promises that we all know will be broken within 6 months or a year. And I think it's really... I don't think we should dwell on Sona. I think it's going to be usual stuff that we saw under President Zuma and President Ramaphosa's last couple of Sonas. I think we should be talking about more interesting things.
Ish.
Agreed.
Okay, fine. That's a very short answer to my question. Let's talk about more interesting things. What's more interesting than Sona?
Well, I think what was quite interesting on the Republic of Ireland went and had an election on Saturday. And for the first time since they became independent in the 1920s, one of the two main parties that emerged as the biggest party, and I'm probably going to butcher this pronunciation, but Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, the two big parties, and they're pretty much similar ideologically, kind of centre-right, not too much difference between them. And they've always kind of alternated in who runs Ireland. But now on Saturday, Sinn Féin, who was basically the political wing of the Irish Republican Army, and caused a lot of, I mean, they were one of the biggest causes of the troubles in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
They actually merged as the single biggest party. They won a quarter of the vote, which is a full 10 percentage points better than they did in the last election. But because of Ireland, so Ireland's got 160 members in their parliament. Sinn Féin actually came second, even though they had the biggest...
They got the plurality, but they...
So they got
the electoral college means it gets less.
So their system is kind of complicated. You elect three MPs for each constituency and single transferable vote. So you rank your candidates and so on, and then person who's least popular falls out. And so it's pretty complicated. But that's why Sinn Féin actually got the second highest amount of seats, even though it got the most votes. So Fiona Foyle, who's been in... who was in opposition now, they emerged as the biggest party with 38 out of the 160 seats. And the incumbent government, which is Fine Gael, and Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, his party came third with 35 seats. So, probably do the maths. There's no party that can form a majority on its own. And the rest of the votes were split between six other parties and 19 independents. So it's going to be whoever's going to... going to be quite a task to cobble together a governing majority. And the two establishment parties have already said they're not prepared to work with Sinn Féin, although there seems to be some rumblings that they're prepared to do this. But to get to the point I'm trying to make, I think this is another... it shows what's with a lot of fragmentation in European politics, where people are sort of moving away from... it's kind of been a tradition in Europe where... centre-right party will govern for 5 to 10 years and people get sick of them, then vote for the centre-left party. They govern for 5 to 10 years. I think Germany's a good example of that. CDU will govern for a while, normally the support of the FDP. Then the guys who are a bit more left, the Social Democrats will come in, they'll govern for 5 to 10 years. I think Germany's also a good example where we see this kind of fragmentation. With lots of smaller parties coming into German politics, the Greens, Alternative for Germany, which has got... some worrying characteristics.
Yeah.
You've been called a fascist and so on. But I just think this is it's a broad, broader phenomenon in Europe where people are getting sick of the establishment parties and moving to smaller parties. And this isn't always, people worry and they say these, right-wing populists coming to power. But as we've seen, it's not always... just the right-wing guys who people are going to vote for if they get sick of the establishment parties. We've seen, the Greens, despite some of the Green parties in Europe are a bit crazy, but the German Greens are actually pretty sensible, and they've got some quite liberal, and on some issues. Don't roll your eyes, Gabriel.
I really disagree on the matter of nuclear. I think Germany is decommissioning nuclear.
It's quite interesting how a lot of liberals who don't feel comfortable in the Free Democratic Party in Germany have actually gone to... the Green Party. Just shows you, I think, as I say, so this is a broader phenomenon in Europe where people are getting sick of the establishment parties. And although this didn't happen in the UK so much, the Tories won quite a big a majority.
Yeah, they seem to be consolidating.
I think we did see this in the Brexit vote where, to remain in the EU was kind of the establishment position. But ordinary British people, the slight majority, felt that they didn't want to be in the EU anymore. And we saw what happened in Brexit. So I think this, the Irish election, as I say, it's a reflection of what's happening in Europe. And I think it's probably the rest of the world as well, even here in South Africa, where only 30% of eligible voters voted for the ANC last year. So we've also seen a bit of a fragmentation. The ANC had its worst ever worst ever result. So I think maybe it's a broader phenomenon in the world in general.
So one of the things Sinn Féin seems to have called for is the introduction, the mandation of a referendum on unification of Ireland and Northern Ireland. When the Troubles came to a conclusion with the Easter Sunday Good Friday Agreement, that was sort of set up as a potential thing to go forward, and they seem to want to pull that trigger. Sarah, how do you read that potential development?
Well, what's interesting is, and it's something a hell of a lot of us could learn from, and perhaps the Middle East in particular, is the fact that there are two things at play. One is that populism is not solely a right-wing phenomenon.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that if enough time passes and people's lives change, and Ireland would be no different, particularly having been through the history it's been through, parties do offer something different to what they would have offered 10 years ago or 20 years ago, whatever it may be. So parties adapt to some extent should adapt to what what people want to vote for.
I think the Tories in the UK is probably a good example.
Yeah, the Tories in the UK. Sinn Féin has a sort of an ideological quality because they were effectively, as you say, the IRA. They were the IRA. They were the political wing of the IRA, and bear a lot of responsibility for some for some absolute horrors. But on this, on the other hand, we've now reached. We have come 20 years down since that agreement, and
well, I think
change kind of happens.
A lot of people apparently Sinn Féin did well with younger people, so probably for a lot of those people, I mean, sort of they've only heard about the troubles from their parents.
Yeah. It doesn't resonate in the same way. And the ANC is going in the opposite direction for the same sort of reason. It's sort of sinking because it's not
attracting. I've got two points from my side about Ireland. One is that I think one of the big worries is having a referendum for unification. If that referendum then goes positive, to say yes, we'd like to reunify, it will probably increase the friction between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. The unionists in Northern Ireland that would probably that prefer to stay in the UK are going to see that as a threat. Those who want to leave the UK, see it as a colonial dominant force, who kind of see the Gaelic Irish as a kind of a race or an ethnicity
Ireland's
that should
first
be unified.
Sort of modern colony, if you will. You know, we understand colonialism.
And very much the Black Irish sort of theatrical tropes, a lot of the same kinds of things that we identify with here as being hangovers or after effects of the colonial project remain there. And I think it's part of the potential existential threat both to United Kingdom and to this idea of the of a state that includes several peoples as a comfortable way to go about things. And it could set up both economic and I think political turmoil, but on the other hand, it's an important if people want that, then I think it's best to deal with that through the democratic process rather than to try and repress it.
That's probably the only thing that might limit Sinn Féin at this stage in putting forward and going for achieving a referendum is the fact that it isn't a majority party.
Yeah,
but say what if we do have a referendum in Ireland now, say in the Republic of Ireland, say whatever 60% of people vote for unification. And in the Northern Ireland, 55% of people vote against it.
Then it won't go through. According to the Good Friday Agreement, you need a majority in both. And that's one of the other things is if Sinn Féin pulls this trigger too early and the referendum goes against reunification, there's a really strange thing where the Northern Irish might actually vote for reunification, but then it wouldn't be able to go through.
Yeah. Mm. But I was looking at the demographics of Northern Ireland and Protestants, who generally unionists, are still in the majority, but not by much, though. I mean, they make about 48% of the population, and the Catholics make up 40 to 45%. So, and still, I mean, it's also just crazy to think that there's still this kind of tensions in Ireland. I mean, people are all effectively at the same color, same religion, same language, and they hate each other more than many people in the world. I mean, just to tell a joke quick, because I heard about a South African Jewish guy who was in a pub in Belfast, and he went into the pub and Irishman said to him, "Are you a Protestant or a Catholic?" So the fella said, "No, I'm Jewish." So he said, "Are you a Protestant Jew or a Catholic Jew?"
Yeah, exactly. The second point that I want to make about the Irish is that I learned journalism or started to learn journalism under probably Ireland's most famous journalist, who happened to be teaching lessons in this American university, Fintan O'Toole. He was a theatre critic who then became a political critic or critic of political theatre, which I think became an increasingly attractive lens through which to look at things as people became more and more disillusioned with the new peace that they had managed to achieve. And the story that he has most consistently told is of Ireland being the protagonist in a grand morality tale told by capitalists and sort of EU free traders. Ireland has some of the lowest tax rates in Europe for a proper country. I'm not counting Luxembourg or Monaco as proper countries. It is sometimes considered for that reason to be a tax haven. Its taxes aren't nearly that low. Most of it is legitimate business. It had HQs of some of the biggest FANG American corporations. So it's been very sophisticated in terms of tech, fintech, and finance more broadly. In that way, Dublin has tried to be a sort of a hit above your weight, welterweight kind of competitor to London, which is in many regards still Europe's financial center. And they've done really well out of it. So the thought is if you're taxing at 30% rather than 50%, but you get GDP growth consistently of 5% rather than 3%, then you can end up quite quickly collecting more tax revenue than you would if you were in a more centrist rather than right-wing kind of regime. And using that revenue, you can do the same amount of good, but with a perpetual growth cycle. And Ireland has one of the highest GDPs per capita in the world, the Republic of Ireland. It's doing really, really well.
And they were a very poor country 50 years ago.
50 years ago, incredibly poor. 20 years ago, they had political strife as bad as South Africa. So the peace and stability and prosperity that the Irish have managed to achieve is really the great, in the morality tale where we say austerity, small government, private enterprise, really unleashing people's personal capacities, the liberal kind of morality tale that you want to tell of if you just delay your gratification for a moment, you're going to get so much more, is the story that Ireland tells. Now, Fintan O'Toole keeps bringing that up because he thinks that it's a lie and has tried repeatedly to sort of poke holes in it and say that what you really need is a more socialist regime. And I think that that way of looking at things seems to have found serious traction in Sinn Féin's win. And so it's just to say that there is implementing liberal policies and those liberal policies achieving economic growth over a fairly sustained period, and then it being halted by the American housing crisis, which then became a global financial crisis that undid some of the good work in Ireland. It's had some recovery, but it hasn't recovered nearly as well as America. You can sort of win the battle of ideas, you can win the policy debate, and then still lose again in the long run, because as you both have said, you know, new generations come through, they've got new experiences, they've got new ideas, and kind of there's just this fashionable swing that whatever has been the establishment, being the establishment itself becomes uncool.
Well, we've seen how many young millennials in the West are going on about how great communism is. You know, the gulags maybe weren't that bad, you know.
Yeah, it's crazy. You should speak to someone who went to a gulag. Okay, anyway, so it's just a really important story to watch, I think, because they are that poster child either, and now they'll try to be a poster child for something else.
And I mean, the thing is, if, say, this referendum does go through and Northern Ireland does decide to go to, I mean, to reunify with Ireland, I mean, that's going to be the end of the UK, possibly. I mean, the Scots might not hang around.
Yeah.
And but then, I mean, that's crazy. I mean, the UK is started in 1707. So, and they just also got, relevance for people in South Africa. Remember, South Africa is a much younger country than the UK. And there may be centrifugal forces even stronger than in the UK.
Secessionists here in Catalonia, exactly. In parts of Eastern Europe. I mean, it'll be hugely inspiring.
Yeah, yeah.
To secessionists around the world.
Exactly. And I mean, that could also have also other issues for the EU. I mean, the Scots probably won't be allowed into the EU if they become independent, because the Spanish won't want the secessionist country to join, because the Catalonians and all kinds of complications.
Yeah, so just to make clear that analogy, Scotland could defect from the United Kingdom and then not get into the EU, so that it becomes quite a small little pimple on the side of a very large economy. And the same for Northern Ireland. The problem is, if Sinn Féin pushes the referendum too soon and the Republic of Ireland votes against reunification, but the Northern Irish are campaigning at the same time, they go for reunification, for abandoning the UK, they'll also be isolated on the little fringe. And then you've got two tiny little countries that might not really be able to fend their way. So
Scotland's got 5 million people, and if the oil, there's a problem with the oil, it's going to be Venezuela on the North Sea, so
yeah.
You know, it's not not such a, you know, easy thing for the Scots.
Yeah. Okay. So potentially hazardous situation, but very interesting to watch, and we'll see how they play it out. Okay, Sarah, if you have a moment, don't you want to tell us about Joseph Shabalala, a great South African, I think, who has recently passed. This is the
one. I mean, it's sad because Joseph Shabalala, at the age of 78, has just died. He was the founder of Ladysmith Black Mabazo, which is a phenomenal success, but it started in the 50s and it grew like most successes, slowly and inexorably over time as things changed. The lovely thing about their name is Ladysmith is where they come, where the group comes from. Black is the refers to the ox, the strength of the ox, and Mabazo is this axe which destroyed all its competition. They were formed in 1960, and they became a real force from 1964 onwards. Gradually, they got onto radio, and in the 70s, they cut an album, and that album, album followed album, and some of the albums went gold, and some even went platinum. But they were so successful that they were barred from competition because they always won the competitions. And they specialize in a very distinctive Zulu South African idiom of isiKhathamiya singing, which is it's so distinctive when you hear it. Mm. But they really shot to fame.
It's really gentle.
It's gentle, but it's so. And he had this incredibly distinctive timbre to his voice.
Mm.
They really shot to fame when they joined Paul Simon on his recording of the album Graceland in 1986.
Mm.
And the result was literally worldwide fame, 5 Grammy Awards, more nominations, and it's just one of those wonderful stories of going from very little to a great deal without having to sacrifice where it is you came from.
Yeah. I was speaking with a colleague just a few moments ago about Ladysmith Black Mambazo. He'd been listening to the Graceland album shot cut with Paul Simon all those years ago, and he was wondering whether it would be possible for something like that to happen today. Morris, oh, sorry, no, what do you think?
I was just going to say, probably Julius Malema.
We must remember that people like Julius Malema are actually a minority in South Africa. And I think, as our research shows, that black and white South Africans get on pretty well. And I mean, just to talk about my own lived experience, I do feel that, in general, black and white South Africans get on well. So I think Ladysmith Black Mambazo Project would be... Yeah, I don't think it's been issued. And we've seen, there have been lots of sort of spiritual successes to Ladysmith Black Mambazo, as in, black and white people working together, Mango Groove, Freshly Ground. I mean, you can name them till cows come home. There's been lots of these kinds of projects in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Ladysmith Black Mambazo is some sort of weird outlier.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the real gatekeepers of fashion and information might have a problem with it. Some band like that's going along now, and I know a couple that are relatively small. They sort of, if they do pop their heads above the parapet, you can get a few accusations on Twitter.
Well, it'll be cultural appropriation. Johnny Clegg's probably the best example of a white South African working with black South Africans, too.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do think he was kind of the personality that sort of drove the thing. It was really a Johnny Clegg project from, looking back on it, it seems.
Yeah, he was.
Well, I might be wrong on that.
He was a great pioneer, but he also, I think he learned a lot, and I think his collaborators were seriously potent musicians in their own right as well. But I think that the story that I just want to underline, I think that Sara was kind of implying and that you were speaking to as well, is that if you do the sort of bar mitzvah and weddings and funeral circuit or private gigs, basically, if you're not relying on newspapers and radio pundits to push you from the start, if you can first build a bit of a base, then South Africa's really ready for it.
Mm.
And I think one of the things that Black Mambazo did really well was then leveraging itself up partly through radio that did not have the same preoccupations we have today. Although, quick sideline story, Johnny Clegg, one of his great songs was a Friday, which I'm feeling a little bit myself this Wednesday. Bring Friday along. And that song was banned, if I'm getting this correct, from Radio Zulu. The Nats obviously had all of the radio stations sort of paired apart like that because they said, he's using some English words here. They already had a problem with him because he was kind of busting some of the fundamental core principles of apartheid.
But poisoning the Zulu language itself.
Yes, they said you are unpurifying Zulu. So they couldn't be played on Radio Zulu. So instead they became the number one hit on Radio Sotho.
I mean, just
because they had different rules.
I mean, that was like, obviously, apart from the horrors of apartheid, just this petty stuff just makes you roll your eyes.
Yeah.
Apparently, like Rodriguez was banned in South Africa, and the censors would go and scratch his record so people couldn't listen to. I mean, it's ridiculous stuff.
It really was very petty.
And this is apart from the really awful,
two
train stops away from genocide stuff,
Yeah. So, but I think, anyway, so to underline the point about Ladysmith Black Mambazo, though, is that they were doing okay. And then once you have international, I think one of the things that happens when you get international kudos, when you get Grammys, when you get the New York Times and the London elite saying that this is seriously good stuff, is that it becomes much harder for the local gatekeepers of fashion to not then seem totally petty as fashion police and saying, no, but you mustn't do this because it's culturally impure. And
we've sort of swung back to that now, the cultural preparation. I'm sure Paul Simon, if he tried to do this now, there'd be some people.
Yeah, so Paul Simon really would get a lot of. But the flip side of that is that he also faced major opposition back in the day. The sort of Dali Mpofu wing of the ANC's effective shadow government, their shadow ministry of arts and culture in exile, considered it to be somehow undermining to the struggle project to have concerts in the UK that were raising money to bust apartheid. If you had black and white people performing together, and if you had people performing who had played at venues like Sun City, because that seemed to ratify the Bantustan. So there was this great irony where you had sort of white women from the UK boycotting, standing outside concert venues and picketing and saying, we can't let Ladysmith Black Mambazo come and play here because they are supporters of apartheid, which they totally weren't. It was just completely backwards.
That happened with Johnny Clegg. I think what the rule was, if you'd ever played in South Africa, then you're a persona non grata, you know, amongst the artist community in the UK. And there was some benefit concert for South Africa, and Johnny Clegg couldn't play because he performed in South Africa. Being a South African and being resident in South Africa, you know, and being music his profession, he kind of has to. But because he played in South Africa, he couldn't play at a benefit anti-apartheid benefit concert in London.
Yeah, no, it's just complete madness. And I do think the wokeistas sometimes wrap themselves in these kinds of sort of just total paradoxes.
Yeah.
And hopefully less of that and more of just beautiful music. And I think that the development of world music, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Paul Simon, Johnny Clegg, these figures created something new. If you look at the history of sort of classical music into big brass jazz bands, into sort of sophisticated jazz in the 50s, and then moving into rock and roll, the great rock and roll revolution, which has become one of the staple musical idioms around the world, you notice that that rock and roll often takes a national kind of flavor to begin with, wherever it goes. And so you've got a sense of what British rock was like, you've got a sense of what American rock was like. As it filters through into Russian, you get a sense of Russian folky rock, and it often does start with folk music. So Bob Dylan is, I think, the most famous living exemplar of someone who goes around, listens to what people are playing kind of in tiny little rural communities, and then finding a way to re-varnish that so that it's appealing to a national audience. But these guys did something else. They sort of, well, maybe they did a similar thing, where they started with a local idiom, but then they developed it and cross-pollinated various kinds of idioms so that you really get a world music kind of idea. And if you look at the history of poetry, of theater, of the novel, if you look at the history of film, all of those sort of human forms of expression, visual arts, sculpture and painting, tend to start out with a kind of nationalist idiom that develops from a folk idiom. And eventually you get world painting. You get, the Cubist movement is something that kind of rises above any particular national identity.
People from Cuba?
No, Marius. People painting like Jacques Brock and Pablo Picasso in a way that deconstructs space.
I'm from the
East End, sorry. And same with film and so on. And so the point is just that world music sort of came long after world film or super international film and super international painting and super international classical music and so on. And Ladysmith Black Mambazo and Johnny Clegg and Paul Simon, they really were hugely important to that project. There were many others, but they did that, and that's sort of a part of world history that I think we can be proud of in both a humanist sense of like this is a cosmopolitan thing that everyone gets a piece of. It's appealing in Japan, it's appealing in California, it's appealing in South America. But it's also got a South African
Le Zulu Blanc.
Yeah. But so it's also got this sort of this South African thing. And I think it's that generally is a project that sometimes gets called modernism. And I think it's a good title for it. To live in the modern age is to be able to find a way of having some national spirit. You don't lose everything that it came from, but at the same time of transcending the narrow confines of like only these kinds of people can only make these kinds of noise and no development from
exactly.
That. Real evolution, real development is something that Ladysmith Black Mambazo was a huge part of in world music, and props to them. And
we wouldn't have had them if they stayed in their ethnic box or whatever the case is.
Yeah. So it's really good stuff. And we remember Joseph Shabalala, and I've been listening to their music. I hope you do too.
It's never been my genre, but I'll have a look.
Just today, have a tune. Listen to Homeless. God, okay, Homeless. Cool. Homeless is a really good song.
Well, rest in peace to Joseph Blala, and obviously condolences to his family and his friends. And yep. Everybody loved his music.
Good. Okay. Have a good Wednesday. If you must, tune into Sona. We probably will find ourselves deconstructing that on Friday. And one last note, I'm going to plug the Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree podcast that I do with Nicholas Lorimer. He's been a little bit under the weather, but on Friday we're going to be talking about Nelson Mandela's release from prison. It's a big thing that we commemorated, you know, sort of 30 years ago to the day, happened yesterday. I don't think we've spoken about it much, and I've got a story that's been sitting on my chest for a long time. So on that more long form podcast, Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree, I'll be talking to that. But we'll have the regular Daily Friend audio and visual version coming out on Friday as well. Thank you very much. If you like what we do, SMS 32823, join the Institute of Race Relations, become a friend of liberty. That's what we try to be.